Hello and welcome. My guest today is Seth Godin. And when I started this podcast some 2.5-3 years ago, I couldn't imagine getting Seth Godin on the show. And if you had told my 12-year-old self that I was having Seth Godin on the show, I'd probably be pretty excited. Seth is an entrepreneur. He is a writer, and he is a marketer who helps teach the world his values and his perspectives. And he does that through his daily blog. He's been writing daily on his website for at least a decade, if not more. And this conversation was about some of Seth's earliest memories, like the time that he realized he was a teacher and the time that he realized he was a good speaker and storyteller. But we also covered letting go of goals, what Seth is hiding from, his vices, and the unexpected challenges with being known. Seth is a treasure of a human being, and I got immense value from not only having this conversation, but then rewatching it back since this episode was recorded in February of 2023. If you did enjoy this episode, share it with somebody you think will enjoy it as well, whether that be through Twitter, Instagram stories, text message, group chat. It all goes a long way in helping the show grow. And I love seeing the quotes that people are posting about specific episodes and from specific episodes. So if you're taking note of this episode, there are so many quotable moments, even though it's just a 40-45 minute episode. So pay attention for those. And let's get right into the episode with the legend, Seth Godin.
I think what I've been trying to do is help people realize that significance is available to them, to stop being brainwashed by industrial indoctrination, to stop paying attention to whether this will be on the test, and to realize we only get this one precious life. Are you doing work you're proud of?
Seth, thank you for coming on the podcast. Really grateful and honored. You're an inspiration. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Danny. I know how hard it is to show up on the regular, and you're well into the three figures, almost four. So the least I could do is cheer you on.
I appreciate that. Let's start off in a place you don't often get asked, which is trustyourself.com. Why do you own trustyourself.com?
Well, I have a little bit of a domain acquisition habit that goes back to an article that was in Wired magazine by Josh Quitner in 1993-94, in which he bought McDonald's.com and chronicled trying to give it back to the corporation, and they couldn't even figure out who to connect him to. And right after that came out, I said to some people I was working with, I'm going to go buy a bunch of domains. And they said, don't do that. And I ended up buying a few, but I didn't buy the 100 that would have made me independently, wildly, you know, driving a Lamborghini sort of wealthy. But one of the ones, this is okay, this is a long story because you started it. So one of the domains was either astrology.com or horoscope.com. I can't remember which one. I owned one of those. And I started one of the very first internet companies right around then, and funded it out of my own pocket for a while. And then I was Fred Wilson's first independent investment with Jerry Colonna. But it was hard. And we needed to make sure that we were making payroll and that we were growing. All the long way to say that Bill Gross calls me up and he says, I see that you own astrology.com. I'd like to buy it from you. We can give you stock in this thing I'm building. And I said, you know what? I believe in you as much as the next person, but I can't pay my employees in your stock. So why don't you just go ahead and send me $20,000 and we'll call it even. And I said this even though the company didn't own the domain, I owned the domain personally, but I needed to route the money through the company so I could pay my employees. And so I took the 20K and he said, oh, I'll throw you some options anyway. I forgot about the whole thing. And 2.5 years later, Yahoo bought my company. And I was one of 5 VPs. And the general counsel comes to my office. Now, you don't usually get a visit from the general counsel. It's not a good thing. And he says, do you know anything about this? And I said, well, I don't, depends. Is it good? And he has a check for $450,000. That was what the shares that the company now owned had turned into. Well, first of all, it was my money, except I put it through the company. So it wasn't my money anymore. It was Yahoo's money. And secondly, in those days, Yahoo's was trading at least 100 times earnings. So I contributed all through that one action, $45 million. So for that reason, I've been hooked on owning domains ever since. I own trustyourself.com because the real title of the practice, my best-selling book about creativity, was Trust Yourself. I even have a Trust Yourself hat. The Trust Yourself hat costs more than the Trust Yourself domain, but the brilliant Nikki Papadopoulos, my editor, persuaded me that the practice was a better title. So if you know anyone who wants to buy trustyourself.com for $450,000, I would be happy to sell it to them.
What a wonderful story. There's so many places we could go from there, but the one that, first of all, why did people tell you not to buy domains?
The idea at the beginning was that the internet was non-commercial and dot-coms were going to be this other thing. And you were supposed to not be a dot-com broker or hoarder. You were supposed to pick the one dot-com name that described you and your business, and that was it. So I was going to get rangers.com and, you know, because, or united.com, because the word united can apply to lots of things. Now it's obviously an airline. But there were lots of businesses that could have been called United. Me buying United for $20 and then selling it 6 months later was a very smart business thing that I did not do. But it felt icky in the early days of the internet.
Take me through what it was like in those early days and how you've seen it develop and grow. But how different is the internet today than you once expected it to be back then?
So I was a techno-utopian. I thought that almost nothing but good things were going to come from what we were describing, because I was at this from the very beginning. I believe that humans are inherently good, that we can seek significance and do work that we care about. What I failed to calculate were two things. One, anonymity, which causes people to do bad things. If someone walks into a bank with a stocking over their head, they're probably not there to make a deposit. I'm just saying. And number two, the selfish needs of media. That once media companies discovered that they could make a profit pitting anonymous people against each other, they decided to do that in a big way. And once people like Instagram decided that making millions and millions and millions of teenage girls fundamentally unhappy for the rest of their lives was a way to make a profit, they decided to do that. So these were things I didn't fear or expect, and I'm disappointed by. But I also know that it is the biggest shift in the history of 10,000 years of humanity, that you and I are having a conversation right now, and I've never met you before. I don't even know what city you're in, and we got right into it in 2 minutes. That was inconceivable just 30 years ago.
On the point of media and how it shapes culture, you have this quote here, which I really liked and pulled out in my research, which is, we believe we see the world as it is, but we live in culture, and culture changes what we see. And culture is driven by media, and media is driven by a business model.
Right.
How does that resonate?
Well, I mean, the model of the internet, which, so when I started Yoyodyne with my own money, we needed to be profitable every month or we were going to have to go out of business. We quickly had a competitor called iOne that had raised $70 million in cash. So it was really hard to compete against that. And the idea that an idea could get millions of dollars and then find customers who didn't have to pay to be customers shifted what got built, because you could delay the creation of value for a long time. And that, plus the network effect, meant that certain natural monopolies would show up, like, you know, YouTube or Google or Facebook, et cetera. And over time, if they didn't have competition, they would stop paying attention to what users needed and wanted because the switching costs were too high. And so we ended up with something that was the opposite of what the founders set out to do.
How do you think about changing that structure and changing the culture? Obviously, it's your life's work, in a sense, to change the culture. But what are some of the wins you've noticed along the way where you're like, wow, what I'm doing, the work that I'm doing is actually making an impact? Does anything come to mind?
Well, those are two different questions. The first one, as a media theorist, is that federation and what Cory Doctorow calls adversarial interoperability, which is a lot of syllables but useful, are the answer. That Mastodon is doing a fine job of not crashing because there is no such thing as Mastodon. There is just a protocol that anybody who wants to can use. And once you have protocols, then we can become the better angels of our nature because you can build something without Mark Zuckerberg's permission. Mm. And podcasting has lasted much longer than I expected, and that's part of the reason. There's no one in charge of podcasting. I have no idea if podcasting.com is even a thing. Doesn't matter. What matters is if you find your 1,000, your 5,000, your 10,000 listeners, and your expenses are pretty low because you don't have fancy microphones and cameras, then you could do fine, right? And that is the internet at its best. So federation, lots of independent entities interacting with freedom, that's what markets do when they work properly. In terms of my work, I think what I've been trying to do is help people realize that significance is available to them, to stop being brainwashed by industrial indoctrination, to stop paying attention to whether this will be on the test, and to realize we only get this one precious life. Are you doing work you're proud of?
So I was 15 years old, understanding that message, reading your blog. I'm 27 now for context. And what would happen was all these incredible experiences happened to me as a result of writing this blog. I was covering the New York Knicks, and I would go to games, and I was showing up at Media Day, all because of this little blog, which was a wild thing for a 15-year-old to be at these incredible places, all because I put my thoughts out on the internet. I knew this, and I understood it at an early, early age. The problem was I got roped into the default path by my parents, who are incredible people, but they want the best for me. And they seem like smart people who have made themselves successful. And so at 17 years old, 2 years of writing this blog, seeing some success, I stopped doing it because I wanted to be a normal kid. And then it's only 25 that I come back to it. I tell you that long story as a way of asking you, there are that 15-year-old kid is listening to this, and I'm curious what you would say to him to keep going when his parents, who are smart, are telling him to do something else.
I think it's pretty easy to say that every generation is an embarrassment to its parents and vice versa. That your parents really broke their parents' heart because they didn't become coal miners or whatever the hell it was, right? Mm. And so that's part of why we call them generations, is that the rules are different. The fact is that a kid who's 10 years younger than you, who has a following on TikTok, their parents are calling an agent. Their parents aren't busy telling them that they have to stop. And that's a mistake too, because, right, the cycles just keep coming around. So what I would say to you or to anybody who's coming up is ignore the details of the platform and focus on who's it for and what's it for. What is the change you seek to make? The tools are going to keep changing. The makeup of the audience will change, but the way it makes you feel to bring a idea to someone who needs to hear it, the way it makes you feel to be seen at a Knicks game as Danny with a blog, not Danny who's a kid, that feeling is the feeling you want going forward. So it could be that going to medical school or whatever was the right thing to do so you get that feeling again. But our lives are just a collection of feelings and impacts. So worry about that. Don't stick with your platform just because that's the platform you started with.
Love that. When you think about that feeling for you, when was the first time you felt like the work you were doing made an impact on somebody and it hit you at a deep level?
1977, in a canoe, north of Toronto, and in a provincial park. I was a canoeing instructor. Canoeing, I could talk about all day, but I won't.
Please.
And a young woman who was 14 was in the other canoe. And I was teaching her how to paddle a 16-foot-long boat by herself, which is, even for kids, a privilege, a rare thing, to be in charge of something like that. And this young woman was 6 inches taller than all of her peers. And if someone disagreed with her about something, she would just punch him in the face, break their nose, walk away. And we spent half an hour together, and she never punched anybody ever again. And it's not because I'm a miracle worker. It's because I took the time to see her, to give her space, to help her imagine what control for her could feel like. And I realized in that moment, I didn't need to do things as much as I needed to help other people do them, if I could do that by turning on a light. And so I certainly do things, but my instinct is more to be a teacher.
That came up time and time again when I was doing research for this, on how teaching is really the calling of your life, or rather the thing that you consider yourself to be. That situation is being in the canoe and teaching that woman what to do. That's an impactful situation. That 30 minutes of seeing her, of being with her, what was said and how did you go about really being with her?
I would be lying if I told you I remembered exactly how it went, but I would guess it was like this. We spent very little time talking about tactics and the specifics of the problem. First, it really helps to know that there is a problem. It really helps to be able to understand that you're not getting what you want by doing what you do. Because if you think you're getting what you want, then you're not going to change. But if you can acknowledge that what you've been doing hasn't been getting you what you want, now there's an opportunity. And then the rest of it was about what was missing in the foundation that she was bringing to the world every day. And what was missing, because there's so much misogyny in the world, because parents are busy and because society wants people to feel a certain way, is she just didn't feel competent. And when someone challenged that competence, she could do the thing she was competent at, which is be physical. So I helped her become very competent at paddling a canoe by herself. And the way you do it is you have to lean it all the way over till it almost tips. And in that moment of almost tipping, you're in a liminal state. You're halfway between here and there. And that's what it is to be alive, to be in a liminal state. And at 15 or whatever, you don't get a lot of experience in feeling that thing. Instead, everyone tells you you have to wear sneakers to this family event and that the prom requires this, because you're all trying to fit in. And teaching a kid to juggle, teaching a kid to walk on a slack rope, teaching a kid to paddle a boat, teaching a kid to win at quiz night, these are things that give them the ability to do everything else in their life better. Hmm.
The internet very much rewards people who don't fit in, because it allows them to find the others like them. How do you think what would your life have entailed if you were born, I don't know, 50 years earlier, and it was a more difficult path to, when it's the society is trying to push you into a box, and you're clearly, and I feel like I'm clearly someone who's not, can't be really put in a box. Yeah. What do you think your life would have entailed?
Oh yeah, 5 years earlier. I mean, I certainly wouldn't own a Jerry Garcia action figure. We have a big problem in our culture with neurodiversity, and I am not on any medical spectrum, but I have mild ADD and, oh, look, a puppy. And I have trouble, you know, doing what the system wants me to do. And I believe at some level that's organic, and at some level I've been rewarded for being an outlier. But in general, my instinct was always to, you know, look for some sort of stimulation. There's a great book about this, about hunters versus farmers. Hunters, which was the first, 50,000 years of human existence, notice tiny little changes in the woods, get very excited for a little while, and then chill. Whereas farmers have to persistently and consistently do it exactly the right way. So we built a farming culture for a long time, followed by an industrial culture. You can't be on the assembly line and make stuff up as you go along. The assembly line does not like that. So what we did with people who weren't neurotypical is we held them back. We made fun of them. We pushed them into unsatisfactory lives. And we're still doing it. We're still doing it way too much, because we have false proxies about what we think leads to contribution. But the good news is we're getting better at it. And I don't know what I would have done, but I do know my days wouldn't have been as joyous as they are now.
And you wouldn't help make other people's days as joyous as you make mine by appearing on this podcast. When you had lunch with Charlie Hoehn, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, H-O-E-H-N, he said that you had a coffee with him, and at the end of it, he asked you for just one piece of advice. And you told him, go start something right now. I don't care if it's an eBay store, because the sooner you run something, the sooner doors will open. I'm sure you gave that same advice today. What compelled you to say that, and why is that so important to start something?
I think that people trick themselves into believing that painting is a talent that we're born with. That, you know, Vincent van Gogh, he had something, but you don't. Well, but if he had lived 500 years earlier or later, there's no way he would have done oil painting, even with the same DNA. Painting is this creative act, sometimes in some cultures, that's a version of starting something. Because you don't get to paint Starry, Starry Night again. You got to paint a new painting. That is what starting is. I don't know how this is going to work out. This might not work. I wonder if anyone will think this is valuable. I wonder how I show up as a professional. I wonder how I say something that's never been said before. That's what it is to be a human. And, you know, we look at OpenAI and ChatGPT-3, and the fact is it's a great demo, and it's really cool to see, and I log on and argue with it several days a week. It doesn't know how to start things. And I think over time it will develop patterns that look like starting things, but it doesn't know the feeling of starting something. So in Charlie's case, I have a lot of respect for him and his passion and compassion. But the thing that you need to make it magic is the guts to start something. And the way you get that is by starting something.
When doing research for this, I was fascinated by that you didn't consider yourself a writer, or didn't consider yourself someone who could write, when all you did for the past 20 years is write every day. It just goes to show that who we think we are, even after we do the thing, isn't necessarily who we are. And we can choose to be a new thing in any given moment. And you've chosen day after day after day for decades to be a writer. How do you go from being somebody who compiles all these books? People talk about the 20 bestsellers. They don't talk about the 120 books before that. How do you go and have that, but then not think of yourself as a writer, even though you've compiled all of those books? And then how do you make the decision?
Okay, so your research is great, but this is the first mistake you've made. It's not that I didn't consider myself a writer. It's that other people said I wasn't a writer. My high school English teacher said I wasn't a writer. She wrote in my yearbook that I was the bane of her existence and I would never amount to anything. In college, I took one English class and got beaten up. In book publishing, when I was a packager, people said, do some packaging. We don't want you to write, because we need writers to do the writing. And so like I did, you know, a dozen novels based on Nintendo games. And I went to Greg, my editor, and I said, I'm paying $3,000 to get a novel written. It's not hard. I can do it all day long. Can I write the next one? And he said, no, we need real writers to write this. So the world was telling me I wasn't a writer. And I still don't think I'm a writer. I just think I write. And those might not be the same thing.
What gave you the inspiration to keep doing and keep asking when you weren't, it wasn't, the world was giving you this feedback, but you said, no, I'm going to write.
The world told me I was good at talking. And I decided to write like I talk. So that's how I can write a book in 3 weeks, because I just say it and then it's done. Other books, when I tried to act like a writer, took a year. Those books don't do as well because I'm not good at that thing. I'm better at just making an argument.
When did you realize you were a good talker?
That's a good question. So there's a Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco, which used to be the tallest building in town, I think. And when I was a teenager, I decided it would become important for me to go to the top of that building, even though there is no visitor program. And I sort of talked my way up to the top. And I didn't make it all the way to the top, but I made it really close. I wasn't scamming anybody. I wasn't hustling anybody. I wasn't keeping them from doing their jobs. I was just explaining to them my argument, and each person thought it was easier to let me go than to stop me. So I guess in those days I said, I'm not the strongest kid. I'm definitely not the best looking kid, but I can explain things to people in a way that makes them more likely to say yes to me.
On that similar topic, you said before that the purpose of a speech is to give energy. Energy is the thing that you are doing when you are giving a public speech. And energy is the thing you're doing when you're convincing somebody to let you go to the top of the pyramid. How do you best convey energy to somebody?
It's an interesting word, energy. I might have said a transference of emotion. Because I'm now talking to you quietly and slowly, but I'm still transferring emotion. So you don't have to be like Gary Vee or me or Tony Robbins to transfer emotion. The point I'm making is, if all you have is a 4-page memo, please don't read it to me. Don't do a TED talk just to read it. You could send it to us much faster. That when we have earned the benefit of the doubt, and then we show up. So if you go to a restaurant, so what has the restaurant done? It has raised enough money to rent a space. It has filled the space with all sorts of artifacts. It has hired people, and then it has sent someone to your table. And that person is going to make or break that evening, even though he or she will never cook an item that you're going to eat, because they're going to transfer some emotion to you, not food, but emotion. The way they read the specials, the way they talk about what it's like to be there, the way they look you in the eye when you're ordering and give you positive feedback for your choices. All of these things are transference of emotion. And restaurants think they're in the food business, but they're not. Frozen pizza is in the food business. Restaurants are in the story business.
One incredible way to transfer emotion is through story. How and what are the most effective ways to tell amazing stories that connect with people?
Well, my friend Bernadette Jiwa knows better than me, and her best-selling books are must-read, J-I-W-A. But I think what a story is just our word for I saw/heard/experienced something that changed my mind. And you get good at that by doing it, by working at ways to change people's minds. So if you were really unlucky in your life and you are no longer able to speak and you're not mobile and you need to get some money so you can have some food, you could imagine how you could tell a physical story on a street corner that would cause somebody to do the right thing and get you help or give you money. And if you're given a TED Talk on the main stage in Vancouver, it's a different kind of story. And the way it makes me feel to touch these playing cards from Penguin Magic is different than the way it makes me feel to touch these bicycles, because these cards, which I just dropped, were made with more care and they just feel different. There's a story here that when you touch these cards, you feel like you understand magic. When you touch the other cards, you feel like you should be playing bridge. And so it's a tactile thing or an oral thing or a smell olfactory thing. It's complicated. And we don't give storytelling enough credit for how complicated it is. And it's a matter of life or death. If you want to get people to vaccinate their kids, it helps to make sure there's a better story being told. And same thing if you want people to start gambling or stop gambling. What are the stories we tell people?
When you look back at your early years and building the foundations for building what you've built today, is you talk about setting goals being an important piece of it, and the goal planner by Zig Ziglar being an essential piece of that. And to use your words, you said, I use that goal planner every day. It's a priceless habit to be able to have, because when you're faced with short-term no, having a vision of a long-term yes is very helpful. I stopped doing it though when I turned 30 because I was getting too focused on the cycle and I found myself becoming more committed to forward motion than I was comfortable with. That to me is so fascinating that you got your start doing something, goal planning, goal setting, and then you had to let it go. Take me through that decision to become less comfortable with forward motion than you wanted to be.
I was lucky enough to publish a goal planner with Zig before he died. I was on stage with him a couple times. He was my teacher at the beginning. The goal planner is priceless. It's super simple. You can download a page of it online for free. You pick 3, 4, 5, 6 things you want to accomplish. You figure out who can help you, figure out what you need to learn, figure out what the steps are. And then every single day, you write down whether you did the steps or not. And if you didn't do the steps, you have to write, no, I didn't do the steps. So wishing that you're going to be able to climb Mount Everest, but you didn't do any of the steps, why are you surprised? You didn't make it. You didn't do the steps. What happens is you become a goal executing person as a result. Mm. And that's going to lead to probably more transactions over time than you might feel comfortable with. And so I was layering new goals on top of my transactional goals. And the problem is goals that are harder to measure the transactions for don't show up in the goal planner the same way, because you can't say, I did that thing where I found peace of mind today, because like, what is that, right? And so who's it for? What's it for? Being very clear about the steps, understanding whether or not the story you tell yourself, which is the most important story, is fueling you getting to where you want to go. And what Zig's book did for 3 years for me was get me out of a big, big deep hole. And then I knew I was going to be okay in a less rigid structure.
How do you know?
Because when I stopped, like, we've all been hustled, right? Mm. And often people who hustle, who like are going through the email list and sending a note every single X number of days or following this hack or that hack, it just doesn't work. And so as a book packager, if I'm calling up each editor every 8 days and asking them, you know, the touch points, that's just not going to get me to where I want to be as a respected writer the way doing it less formally might. And so I was over the hiding. That's what it did. It got me out of the hiding. And I realized more velocity wasn't going to help me do better. I needed more judgment.
What were you hiding from?
Oh, we're all hiding from failure. Because failure is an inch away from being dead.
It's funny because, I mean, I'm thinking, where are you currently hiding from in your own life?
It's always hard to tell what you're hiding from in the moment. It's easy to tell after the fact. But I am really lucky that I have earned the benefit of the doubt from the people who I was hoping would trust me. And I don't want to blow that. And the thing you have to be careful of is part of what it is to do innovative work is that you might do something that doesn't work, and that might cost you some benefit of the doubt with some people, even if you do it with good intent, right? And so, you know, poor David Blaine, the magician, if he shows up and doesn't do a miracle, well, all of a sudden, at least one person is going to think he's not supernatural. He's worked very hard to earn that benefit of the doubt, and all of a sudden, it's gone. So it gets harder and harder to go do difficult magic tricks when you're David Blaine, because you are worried that this thing that was so precious to you might go away. And that's why when you think about it, a magician like Joshua Jay, he's turned around and said, I can make miracles when I want to, but I'm going to build an institution that trains the next generation of magicians and offers them a different way of thinking, because that's a new thing for me to do, not doubling down on the old thing. And so that's often how I spend my cycles.
So now that you've gained, what is it that you've gained now that you were seeking then that you feel as if you have to uphold?
When I was 30, when people said that will never work about what I was doing, no one would ever disagree with them. And now, often when I tell someone, oh, I got a new book or I'm working on a new software product, the easiest thing to say is, that's probably going to work. Because it might, but I've been doing it a long time. There aren't as many people around who are saying, this guy is a complete failure. No matter what he does, it never works. And that's a benefit of the doubt that is assigned by caste and race and social status, but it's also assigned by work history. And having been in both shoes, it's more fun when people believe you.
What was the moment when you said, oh, wow, I now have the trust, or I now am in a different position than people not believing it when it worked? How long was that period?
Oh, I think it was at least 20 years.
20?
Yeah.
But so it wasn't until you're 50.
Yeah. I mean, in public speaking, after my first TED talk was viral and, you know, Bono said he liked it, then when I get on stage, people laugh at my jokes more because they're not like, who is this person? Well, then it gets much easier to give a talk because you're the headliner, right? The headliner gets the benefit of the doubt. Yeah, I didn't get that sort of benefit of the doubt as a public speaker until after I was 40.
And then now do you feel some sort of, how is the pressure of dealing with people expecting you to do magic when you speak? Does that come in? You don't think about it?
No, I don't go on airplanes anymore because it was a crutch to feel that feeling. And I also felt like a cannibal burning all that fuel. And I was after 1,000 nights on the road, I was like, I need to just stay home. So I just walk away from it. I still will do a gig in person in New York, but you know, it used to be if you and I were talking on a Tuesday, I would say, yesterday I was so-and-so and 2 days from now I'll be so-and-so. Instead, I was just on a Zoom call. And Zoom is great, but you don't get any of that emotional benefit of the doubt thing the way you do at a live event.
How has cutting down on the travel made you a better writer?
Well, it made me a less productive writer because I only used to write on airplanes. And so 8, 10, 12 hours a week of typing, that's a lot of writing. So I had to create new patterns. It has almost certainly broad. I don't write about hotel showers anymore. because I've not been in a hotel shower in a long time. So I think my readers appreciate that because my writing on hotel showers is overdone.
You said before that you don't have any vices. What's the closest you've ever come to a vice?
I have vices. I just don't have any socially acceptable traditional vices.
Oh, I love that correction.
Drink cigars or vodka or anything like that. But like I eat bean to bar dark chocolate more than any doctor would recommend and on and on. So no, it's not that. It's that there are social settings where having a vice would have come in handy and I didn't have one.
Hmm. Could you speak a little bit more about
that? Well, it's how did they become? Like, you know, I get that alcohol has an effect on people's systems, but it's also a social lubricant just to talk about it. The whole ritual of ordering the wine and pouring the wine and talking about the wine. Well, that's because we needed a social lubricant and we needed a way to sort of be in sync with other people. So if you want to talk about 300B traditional 8-watt amplification on high efficiency speakers, we can get our stuff going in 5 minutes, no problem. But I can't talk about that with most people because they have no clue what I'm talking about.
What are some of the unexpected challenges of being such a wide-ranging and different thinker than the rest of the world?
Well, first, Danny, I appreciate you being a fan, but almost nobody knows who I am. And I'm fine with that. So most of the places I go and most of the people I interact with have no clue. And that's great. I'm not there for them. They're not there for me. I get to live my life like a normal person. The biggest downside is it's tempting to put things in a box because you've seen it before. Because my job is sorting things and deciding that's important and that's not. Excuse me. And so it's so easy to be wrong. And figuring out how to give the benefit of the doubt. Like I don't use TikTok. I don't want to use TikTok. But I got to assert, excuse me, that TikTok works because a lot of people use it. Yeah. So I got to decode why without getting the joke. And I'm going to have to wrap this because I can't speak anymore. I apologize.
Absolutely. No worries. Sorry about that. I hope you have an incredible rest of your day. I appreciate your time so much. And I have notes on notes on notes. So hopefully, God willing, we could do a part two. So that was Danny from February 7th of this year. And this is Danny from May 30th. Of this year. I rarely do outros for these episodes, but I feel inclined to because this episode ended quite abruptly. I asked Seth for a challenge, and he said the following. It's pretty simple. Find two people to coach and have a weekly call with them. The three of you will accomplish amazing things. So, you made it to this point in the episode. And I would like to extend the offer. If you would like to be one of the two people coached by me, send me a Twitter DM at @HeyDannyMiranda or an email, danny@dannymiranda.com, and include in the message what it is exactly you would like to get coached on by me. So, looking forward to seeing the messages. Until we meet again, so long.